This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Western Michigan University political science professor John Clark looks at the crowded fields developing in the Democratic primary in the 6th Congressional District and among Republicans running for U.S. Senate in Michigan. But first,
the proposed master plan for the city of Kalamazoo is now available for public comment. Imagine Kalamazoo 2025 is available at City Hall, branches of the Kalamazoo Public Library, and neighborhood associations, among other places. We're going to discuss the plan and what happens next with Kalamazoo City Planner Christina Anderson. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first of all, let's go back to process. How did you develop this plan? How did it all come together?
Sure. Imagine Kalamazoo is actually the process that we went, is the named process that we went through. It was about 15 months of community engagement, wrapped up this spring in April. We started off very broad, showed up at a lot of community meetings, art hop, music hop, and started asking people questions. What does a world-class city look like? What would Kalamazoo of the future look like? Very broad. From that, we started to ask more detailed questions. Oh, Kalamazoo is more walkable in 2025. What does that mean? What does that mean for the city? What does that mean in your neighborhood? And started to slowly break it down into more detailed levels, where we ended up this past winter in having meetings in every neighborhood in the city to talk about what the goals that we heard, the themes that we heard throughout the process, the walkability, complete neighborhoods, economic vitality, friendliness, what do all those things mean for your neighborhood? And how do we help prioritize some of your wish lists and, you know, get them into a document that could be implementable?
So let's talk a little bit about maybe a few of those concepts. Walkability. What does the city of Kalamazoo have to do to become more walkable? Does it mean more sidewalks? Does it mean reconstructing roads? Does it mean some of all of that and maybe more?
I think it means something all of that and maybe more. I think that how walkability is implemented or furthered throughout the city is going to depend on the neighborhood. And that's one of the things that we're trying to define. Is it best for a neighbor to have sidewalk on both sides of the street, a complete network on both sides of the street? Is it okay if we have sidewalk on one side of the street? How wide should it be? What does it look like at commercial areas? Wider at commercial areas? Does it have street furniture like benches, trees, banners, signage? So it kind of depends on where it's located. I think that as when we are starting to look at priorities for where we work first, we ask neighbors, residents throughout the neighborhoods, where do you walk? And we kind of got an idea of destinations, and we heard a lot about walking to parks, walking to schools, walking to those commercial centers nearby. And from that, have developed what we believe to be the priority area, which would be about a quarter mile around those areas as kind of the first pass for the priorities. Do those have the complete sidewalk network? Is the condition of the existing sidewalk okay? Or is there no sidewalk? And kind of looking within that quarter mile area around those sites as the first priority.
So does walkability and being connected then sort of play into one of the other things you talked about there, which is improving the city's neighborhoods?
It does. So in the master plan, we talk about a couple concepts that relate to that. We talk about, in our public meetings, we heard a lot of comments surrounding, I would like my neighborhood to be more walkable. I'd like to be able to walk to the commercial area. What I really would like, though, also is that commercial area to have things in it that meet my daily needs. I want to be able to get the light bulb, the jug of milk, without necessarily having to go across town. If I do want to go across town, I'd love to have another option than my personal vehicle, if I have one. You know, so is it possible to have, make sure that there's a transit stop nearby or the bike route, you know, those options in transportation. And some of these things, we heard them all over the place, all over Kalamazoo, and we took them and started to kind of piece together what a complete neighborhood means in Kalamazoo. Does it have options for transportation? Does it have, do people living in our neighborhoods have access to meet their daily needs in the neighborhood or close by? If not, what's missing? You know, is there access to food through a grocery store, farmer's market, community garden? Is there access to recreation? Is there a park within the neighborhood or adjacent to the neighborhood? And what amenities does that park have? So we've kind of taken all the things that we heard and started to compile what completeness means in our neighborhoods. And that is discussed in the plan. Also discussed in the plan is, okay, once you figure out what that definition is in Kalamazoo, how do we get everybody there?
So there are some things in here about transportation, such as improved bike lanes, greater public transportation access. One of the questions, of course, that comes up is how long is it going to take to construct roads in a way, and how long is it going to take to maybe put in bike trails? Is this kind of an ongoing process that maybe comes when it's time to repave a road or to reconstruct a road?
So what the master plan does is kind of set out a work plan for the city. The master plan focuses mostly on transportation and land use related issues and kind of sets up the community for the work that can be done over the life of the master plan. Master plans generally last about 10 years with a 5-year check-in just to make sure everything's on the right path, right? So it is not, you know, when the master plan is approved this fall, there's not instantly bike lanes everywhere or new sidewalk everywhere, right? It's, you know, setting priorities. We talked a couple minutes ago about how do we start to set those priorities. We talked about a quarter mile around key destinations within our neighborhoods. So the master plan is about setting up priorities and setting up steps to help get there. So for, you know, in talking specifically about bike lanes, in the master plan, you know, we would set up things like, okay, so if there's a new destination, a new commercial center goes in, does it have bike racks? That's part one. So if you, you know, if you're going to get there, where do you put your bikes when you get there? Safe parking. Then, okay, let's spread out. So we talk about the roads leading up to it. Are any of them noted as bike routes? What kind of bike route is it if they don't have one? What kind of bike lane would be a bike facilities would be appropriate for that road? Is it just a sign? Is it a dedicated bike lane? Is it a protected bike lane like you see downtown on Kalamazoo Avenue? And start to lay out parameters for when those types of facilities would be appropriate. So the master plan is all about setting us up for success, making sure that we're understanding the right parameters to achieve, you know, whatever the goal it is, whether it's the sidewalk connections, the new bike lanes, connections with transit. Yeah, so it's all about setting us up for success.
Well, a lot of the things we're talking about here would cost some money. But of course, we've also been hearing about the Foundation for Excellence. If that is successful and gets off the ground, does that make more of what is in this plan possible?
The master plan, the goals in the master plan, I said before that it sets up our work plan, right? And so as departments go forward with their budgeting process, whether it's standard city budgeting or whether it's looking at inspirational projects, it all needs to be tied back to Imagine Kalamazoo and the master plan. And so whenever a project is coming forward, we're going to have to note, okay, this meets our goal to create complete neighborhoods because it ensures more residents are within walking distance of a park, for example. So everything is going to have to be tied back to how it's achieving these goals that we've laid out for us, including the inspirational projects associated with the foundation.
So what is the next step then for the master plan and Imagine Kalamazoo 2025?
Certainly. So the master plan is, we kicked off a 6-week public review period on Tuesday of this past week, August 1st. And it will run, the comment period runs through September 15th. So during that time, we're asking residents to take a look at the plan and provide their comments. And there are lots of ways that comments can be made. If you go to the city's website, the document is linked off the website, as well as a way to comment directly through Open Town Hall. You can type in your comments and send them, and they come directly to me as the city planner. We also have the document throughout the city. It's at the library branches, city offices. It's on Western's campus, K College's campus, KVCC at Anna Winton Hall downtown. We have it at Metro Transit. We have it at coffee shops around town. So there's lots of places where it's located. In every everywhere where that document is located, there are comment sheets, and folks can write on the comment sheet and leave it with the document, and we'll collect it. We are doing a lot of neighborhood presentations. The city will be at a variety of community activities, including in September, the Hispanic Festival. In August, the Mothers of Hope Picnic. We'll be talking about it and collecting comments. On September 12th, we're doing a big citywide meeting where we'll do a presentation of the document. We'll have lots of exhibits from all the community meetings we've had over the last 18 months for people to take a look at and kind of understand where the document came from based on the comment we received. When the comment period closes on the 15th, that just gives us an opportunity to go through all the comments and start to understand, making sure that we've covered all the main concepts prior to the public hearing for the plan. The public hearing is on October 5th in front of the Plan Commission. Now, at that time, it's still open for more comment. It's a public hearing. Folks are welcome to come out, listen to the presentation, and make additional comments that evening. Imagine Kalamazoo as a process, as an engagement process, doesn't end with the master plan. It is going to be ongoing. Any projects that the city does require engagement, whether we're working with the neighborhoods, whether we're doing a road construction project, you know, checking in with the public is the process moving forward. And so Imagine Kalamazoo does not end. It continues even when the master plan is approved.
And is there a date yet for voting on the master plan?
So the process is that the Planning Commission reviews it first, and that's October 5th. Once they review it, they make a recommendation to the City Commission to either approve or not approve the document. And so that would go before the City Commission probably in mid-October.
Christina Anderson, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Christina Anderson is Kalamazoo City Planner. Links with more information about the City of Kalamazoo's master plan and Imagine Kalamazoo 2025 are available at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Is Michigan's 6th congressional district ripe for change? Apparently many Democrats think so. 5 have officially announced that they are running for the seat, which is currently held by Republican Fred Upton. At least one other potential candidate is seriously considering a campaign. It's not clear yet if Upton will be the Republican candidate in the House district because he is considering running for United States Senate. We're going to take a look at the 6th Congressional District with Western Michigan University political science professor John Clark. Thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure.
So there was a time not so long ago when it seemed as though the Democrats had to go out and find somebody to run against Fred Upton, and now there are people lining up for the opportunity. Is there a reason that stands out to you why it would be now that more Democrats want to get into this race?
Well, I think there are a couple of things, one that's somewhat Democratic specific and one that speaks a little more generally to some things that are going on in American politics. With regards to the Democrats in particular, this is not a phenomenon that is unique to our district. In lots of districts across the country, we've seen a number of relatively new to politics folks jumping into campaigns for a whole variety of reasons, but in large measure in response to the Trump presidency. And so the fact that there is a Republican in the White House and there are Democrats and potential Democratic candidates across the country who are angry about that, and connected with that, there were a number of potential Democratic candidates that were energized either by Bernie Sanders' campaign or just generally in the previous election cycle. And so you've got people that are sort of ginned up for a fight, and if they're not very well connected with Democratic Party politics and with prior elective office, then there's no reason for any of them to wait for somebody else. They all jump in together. To a large extent, I think that's what we're seeing here in the 6th District and, again, in other places around the country. More generally, I think the Trump phenomenon suggests that, hey, you don't really have to know a lot about politics. You don't really have to have the kind of resume that we used to think of as being important, and you still can win. That's not to say that most of those candidates without much experience or resume are likely to win. In fact, they're not, generally speaking, likely to win. But it can be done, and Donald Trump is proof of that, that you can run against the establishment of even your own party and still have a chance of winning.
Democrats have looked at the 6th Congressional District and have seen, I guess, a couple trends that have made them think that it is more winnable now than, say, it was 15 years ago. But still, you know, you're talking about if Fred Upton runs for re-election, a 30-year incumbent. That's never easy to win. And again, we have the long history of a Republican winning, even if he runs for Senate and it's a different Republican candidate. So if you're a Democratic Party leader and you're looking at this race as one that you know is not easy, are you concerned that there is going to, at this point, be a primary that doesn't look like any of these candidates plan to back out, and that it could get expensive, and that the ultimate winner of that primary doesn't have the resources that they had at the beginning to then turn around and try to win a general election race?
I think that's definitely a concern. I mean, one of the things that the Democrats have done reasonably well in the 6th District is to coalesce around a single candidate well before the nomination. Now, in some ways, that was because there just wasn't interest. There wasn't competition, and some of those candidates had to be recruited rather than sort of jumping in themselves. But it allowed the general election dynamics of a Democratic challenger running against Fred Upton to emerge much earlier. And in the case of Paul Clements, he was able to put together a campaign organization and to raise some money nationally because of the fact that it was clear that he was going to be the Democratic nominee running against Upton. With a crowded field and a relatively late primary compared to at least some other states, that changing from nomination mode to general election mode happens pretty quickly in Michigan, and particularly when we're talking about raising money from outside the state and establishing yourself and your connections with Democratic-leaning organizations that might provide money, individual donors that might provide money. There's simply not a lot of time to do that unless you sort of dominate the field and, you know, establish yourself at the time of the primary as the clear consensus Democratic challenger that everybody's behind. Looking at this field, it's not clear to me that there's anybody that has that level of name recognition, that level of support early on. Certainly things can change. But at this point, there's not one person that sort of stands out as being kind of head and shoulders above everybody else in terms of their experience or their candidate quality, if we can use that in sort of a generic sense. And as a result, I think it makes it very difficult to see how a crowded field at this point helps any Democrat win the 6th congressional district.
Since you mentioned Paul Clements, let me note that he is one of the five Democrats who has announced they are running again. Should also note, interest of full disclosure, he is a colleague of yours.
That's right.
He teaches
in the political science department and is a great colleague.
Let me, though, ask you about the flip side of that, because I was talking to a Democrat not so long ago who said there could be an advantage to a primary, that it gets the candidates out there earlier, you know, because you have to actually compete to get votes for August. You kind of build up some resources. Maybe you get to fundraise a little earlier. Maybe voters who wouldn't want to hear in May and June about your candidacy in May and June of next year might be willing to listen if they know that there's going to be a vote to cast in 2 or 3 months as opposed to November, and that there might be some resources that ultimately the campaigns, assuming everybody coalesces around the winner, are willing to share when the primary is over and you shift to general election mode. Is there something to that?
Certainly that's a possibility. And, you know, there are historical examples of where that works, but it assumes that all of the folks who are supporting Democrats can coalesce, that it's not a bitter fight, that things don't turn ugly, and that at the end of the day, whatever the outcome, there are resources then that can be shared. I suspect that it's the case that this is going to be a relatively high, this 2018 is going to be a relatively high turnout election, simply because there's going to be a lot of candidates for a lot of offices and a lot of campaigns that are trying to get out the vote. That's something that we often don't see, at least in this part of the state, we often haven't seen. And so, you know, we could see higher turnout that sometimes then translates into higher turnout in the general election. So it's a possibility. But things could also go the other way. And it just is, you know, we're going to have to wait and see how the dynamics play out once we get into a little bit more serious campaign mode.
So let's talk a little bit about the idea of Fred Upton as a candidate for United States Senate. If he were to get into this race, and we should say that he has taken his time here on deciding whether or not to launch this campaign and said that he wasn't going to rush the decision. But if he does get in, what are the obstacles he faces as a congressman who has represented one corner of the state now for 30 years?
Yeah, so there are a number of challenges there. It's worth noting that his name is one that regularly gets mentioned as a possible statewide candidate, whether for the Senate or for some other statewide office. And I think that that reflects the fact that he's viewed fairly positively by opinion leaders, whether it's folks in the media or you know, folks in Republican Party politics, as somebody who can build a coalition and can be successful. Whether or not he's ever been interested, I don't know, and whether or not he'll be interested this time around is difficult to say as well. There are a couple of very clear challenges that all candidates face, but certainly Representative Upton would. He's known in this part of the state, and that gives him a huge advantage should he run for re-election to the House of Representatives. But his statewide name recognition, not so much. It would certainly become a challenge for him in some other parts of the state and even some other Republican parts of the state to demonstrate to potential voters, either in the primary or in the general election, that he's a candidate that they should support. We've just talked about the Democrats in the 6th district in a crowded primary. It looks as though it's going to be a crowded primary for the Republicans when it comes to the United States Senate as well. And so that could create some difficulties. Does he have a clear path when he comes from a district that's fairly competitive, reasonably competitive, but in terms of media coverage is pretty isolated? And so once you get out of the Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo, Battle Creek media market, do folks over on the east side of the state even know very much about him? Do folks in the northern part of the state even know very much about him? And so that would be establishing that name recognition would be an obstacle for him, as it will be for all of these candidates who are in the race or thinking about it, with one unique
exception. Yeah.
We can come back and talk about right. Kid Rock in a minute, perhaps.
Yeah.
But certainly for somebody like Fred Upton, both in the primary and then in the general election as well, that name recognition is going to be a big challenge. And then the other thing that comes into play certainly is that we've got an incumbent United States senator who is both fairly popular, at least based on her track record so far, who's already raised a considerable amount of money, not a huge amount by Senate standards, but a considerable amount of money.
Would be seeking her fourth term, so she's been there a while.
And she's been, she's established herself as someone that folks in Michigan can sort of look to as being a senator. She's done that by most measures reasonably well in terms of both politics and policy. And so whoever gets the Republican nomination is going to have to run against a fairly formidable incumbent, just like should Fred Upton choose to run for re-election, whoever wins the Democratic nomination would have to challenge a formidable incumbent in the 6th congressional district.
So if we look at these two, it's interesting that we're going to compare Fred Upton to Kid Rock this
yeah.
much, but I don't think that's happened a whole lot. But is it fair to say that these two gentlemen are on some different timetables in terms of having to make a decision? I mean, Congressman Upton has said that he's in no rush and he's got no timetable for deciding whether or not to run for U.S. Senate. But if he's going to kind of run a conventional campaign, he might be on one timetable, as opposed to Kid Rock, who, of course, has all sorts of money at his disposal to self-fund a campaign, no problem getting airtime. I guess I'm wondering here if Fred Upton is going to have to make his decision sooner, if it's going to be serious, as opposed to Kid Rock.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I suspect with somebody like Fred Upton, who, if he gets in the race, is going to be a serious candidate. It's not something he's giving up a seat that he's held for
seat,
a long
yeah.
time,
right.
a fairly comfortable. And so if he chooses to run for the Senate, it's because he thinks he can win and because he's going to be serious about it. He's not going to make that decision lightly. It's not going to be a sort of a flip decision. And if that's the case, then whether or not he formally declares, he'll have to be maneuvering in a way that makes him serious when it comes to the Republican primary and then subsequently the general election. It means he's going to be having the kind of fundraising that we typically see for United States Senate races as opposed to what we see for races for the House of Representatives.
And a Senate race is much more expensive than a House
race.
Way
more expensive. And, you know, certainly he's well positioned to raise money. And, you know, that comes from being a long-term member of the House of Representatives. But he's going to have to do that. And that takes time and it takes effort and you've got to be serious about it. He also has to, as we've talked about with his name recognition, he's got to expand that to other parts of the state. And so he's got to find ways to become visible to Republican Party leaders first, but Republican primary voters second across the state. Again, that's doable. But it takes time and it takes effort and it takes you out of the 6th District and it takes you out of Washington, D.C. And doing the business of the House of Representatives. The actual decision of, you know, whether or not to jump in or not can wait. But some of these other things, it seems to me, he would need to get started on relatively soon if he intended to be a serious candidate. And I can't imagine him making that decision without intending to be a serious candidate.
Okay. One last question here. I have not seen any of the polling leak on the 6th Congressional District, which I think at this point in the last two election cycles, there was some sort of polling which came out, which indicated that Fred Upton might be vulnerable. Of course, he won both of the last two elections as he won the ones before that. And then we do have some polling on the U.S. Senate race that shows that Kid Rock actually one poll would be leading Debbie Stabenow. And
sure.
Then in another one, he's well within striking distance. In August of 2017, how seriously should we take any polling for Congress, United States Senate, governor, et cetera?
Not very seriously at all. And, you know, with a lot of these kinds of polls, we shouldn't ever take them too seriously, right? We shouldn't put too much into them because at this point, it's a lot about name recognition. And it's a little about partisanship. It's, well, it's a lot about partisanship, but in terms of, you know, sort of specific candidate versus specific candidate, you know, these things at this point really don't matter very much. That's why we have campaigns. That's why we have candidates put together their positions on issues, get out and meet voters, try and explain why they ought to be the one who's elected. And we're seeing candidates do that at this point. But most voters are not paying any attention to either of these races, frankly, at this point. Having said that, I do think that the 6th Congressional District is potentially more competitive than it has been for Fred Upton in recent election cycles. If we look at the way the district has gone for other offices, it's been fairly competitive, as has been the entire state fairly competitive. And so when it comes to, you know, sort of candidate versus candidate, Fred Upton has a strong base in the 6th Congressional District. It makes it formidable for any challenger. But if Fred Upton is not on the ballot, if he chooses to run for some other office or at some point if he chooses to retire, then all of a sudden you've got an open seat. And then the dynamics are different and, you know, who knows what might happen under those circumstances. It's a reasonably safe Republican district, certainly when Upton's at the top of the ticket. Without him, it would still be a reasonably safe Republican district. But the right Democrat running against the right Republican could make the 6th district awfully competitive.
John, as always, thank you for your time.
Always a good time.
John Clark is a political science professor at Western Michigan University. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.